This episode of the Flush Podcast is brought to you by North Dakota Tourism, Federal Premium Ammunition, Onyx Hunt, Chief Upland, Huron, South Dakota, and by Grain Belt Premium Beer. Today I'm in the Nebraska Sandhills hunting with a couple of Upland Cowboys. We've been hunting for prairie chicken and sharptails this week while following our dogs through this big rolling landscape on horseback. Matt Frugier and Aaron Martin are my guests. We'll tell you what we've seen, what we've learned, and how not to get bucked off a horse, because that might have happened.
The flush. So fast, it hardly seems real. So vivid, the moment freezes in time before erupting in a blur of spurs and feathers. It's why we changed the way upland loads are built with Prairie Storm. Exclusive flight control FlexWad technology and a mix of copper-plated lead and flight stopper pellets combine to create dense, deadly shot strings through any choke. Longer shots, more power, fewer missed birds. Only from Federal.
If you're looking for a great bird hunting destination this season, then I strongly recommend that you consider one of my favorite places to hunt. That's North Dakota. North Dakota is a bird hunter's paradise. You can hunt both waterfowl and upland birds all in the same day. Ducks and geese in the morning, pheasants, sharp-tailed grouse, and Hungarian partridge in the afternoon, or vice versa. North Dakota has a population estimate of 2.9 million breeding ducks, which is 19% above the long-term average, and their prairie pothole region is smack dab in the middle of the central flyway. This year's drought may have had an impact on North Dakota's landscape and some of their bird populations, but there are still regions in the state that have seen an increase in bird numbers this year. Yep, you heard that right. With a little scouting, you just might find yourself in a field surrounded by wild flushing birds, creating memories that will last you a lifetime. North Dakota has approximately 800,000 acres of private land open to public walk-in hunting. For the latest plots guide, visit the North Dakota Game and Fish Department. Bag your limit this fall in North Dakota. Visit legendarynd.com to start planning your hunting adventure today.
The wild is calling. Answer your thirst for adventure with Grain Belt Premium Beer. Bring the Grain Belt to the outdoors with their limited edition premium hunting season pack. It's available anywhere you can find premium 12-pack cans of Grain Belt.
Welcome to another episode of the Flush Podcast. I'm Travis Frank. I'm your host. Brandon Morton, as always, produces this show. But Brandon is a long ways away from me because I'm in the middle of Nebraska, right? Pretty much smack dab in the center. If you hear a ruckus, that's okay, Aaron. You can let him go. If you hear a ruckus, that's one of four dogs running around the room right now. We're having a cup of coffee. I'm sitting at the table here with a couple of Upland Cowboys. Aaron Martin, there they go. There they go, Aaron Martin and Matt Frugier. It's a wild morning, a lot of pent-up energy here, I think, guys. Is that a good way to describe it, Aaron?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to describe it, even though we've been hunting for the last 2 days really hard, and all of a sudden everybody decided they're still spry this morning.
Yeah, we're trying to make a television show, and I think one of the biggest surprises that people have when we spend time with them is how hard we end up having to hunt. They're like, holy cow, we've been going hard. And normally it's us and the dogs that get a workout, but this week is a little bit different because we've added another element to it. We've added the horses to this hunt, which I think is, it's got to be one of the best ways that you can enjoy the hunting experience, because it just changes the way that you can work on the land, but your view watching everything. So whereabouts are we right now, Aaron?
So we are kind of, I guess, west central Nebraska, in the Sand Hills, kind of south of Valentine. We're right around in North Platte. So, it's the Sand Hills country is where we're at.
Yeah, we're sitting at Matt's table. Matt, how long have you lived right here? Because I'm looking over your shoulder right now and I can see, how far is, what's your view here? 15, 20 miles that you can see these rolling hills?
So the ridge line to the east of us here is actually a road. That's only about 5 miles away from here, but from atop that road, you can probably see 25 miles away. So from any highest point out here, 25, 30 miles, depending on visibility.
Yep. I've wanted to hunt this area for a long time because I've heard a lot about it. you know, it's just, it's one of those unique places in the country. But until you're here, you don't realize just how kind of rugged this landscape kind of is. I mean, where we've been hunting, pretty steep draws and hills, and just gorgeous country, though. Just absolutely spectacular.
No, I absolutely. And, you know, I've lived here in Nebraska for 5 years now. We've lived in this house specifically just a little over a year, about a year and a half now. The entire time I've lived in Nebraska, I've hunted the sand hills, and we've always wanted to live here. And so we were able to make that a reality last June. And so you're exactly right. I mean, it's I refer to it as very steep country. Anytime you're outside hunting, you're never traveling on level ground. You're either going up or going back down. And unfortunately, when you're going down, you're going to have to go right back up again.
Right, right.
And so, you know, unlike this is sort of the southern extent of the sand hills. We call these hard hills to some degree. But the sand hills are just kind of mesh right into north of the property, as you've seen. And so I think of this as sort of canyon country mm-hmm. to some extent. And you'll see mountain lions out here. You'll see elk out here. We've got all that, you know, megafauna. But we certainly have a lot of prairie chickens.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And we've seen that firsthand. I think that's kind of the big draw here for people that come to the Sandhills. Obviously, we've flushed pheasants as well, and you've got some quail in this area too. We didn't see any quail yet, which, are you surprised by that?
No, the areas that we would typically see quail are areas that we didn't cover. So our shelter belts will have quail. Some of our thicker draws will as well. Mm-hmm. So the areas of our property where we expect to see them, we just don't typically expect to see an overlay of prairie chickens or sharptail there.
Gotcha. So there's a pretty good size refuge that people come down to hunt, the Valentine Refuge. Is that the main public land property around here that people come for, or is there other areas?
So to the north of us, the closest one and the one I have the most experience with would be Halsey. Okay. That's about 90,000 acres. Valentine would be roughly 70,000 acres or so. And then there's Sam McKelvey, which would be a little bit further to the north and west of us, which is about 120 acres. So the Sandhills comprise, the entirety of the Sandhills comprise about a third of the state of Nebraska, millions of acres. But there are hundreds, I want to say there's roughly 250,000 acres of publicly accessible true Sandhills property in which you can find, you know, a good mix of sharptail and prairie chicken. But yeah, Valentine seems to be pretty popular. All of this country is vast.
Yeah.
We get a lot of people. We get a lot of guys out there hunting and gals. But, you know, generally speaking, the dogs don't know the cover extremely well. And so, you know, success is usually a little bit low, at least in the guys that I tend to interact with. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's becoming a more popular place over the last few years.
Yeah, I think it's popular probably because of just the ability to stretch your legs, you know, and the vastness like you just talked about, and the fact that you can hunt for a bird that, you know, a lot of other states, pheasant seems to be king across bird country, but the popularity, we were talking about this last night, the popularity of other birds too, like sharp-tailed grouse and prairie chicken seem to be on the uptick, that people like to extend their season, different challenges, and, you know, this gives you an opportunity to hunt big land and watch your dogs really work, but also hunt for a bird that is unlike a pheasant. So explain a little bit to somebody that's never hunted for prairie chicken, the difference between hunting them right now, like we are, and hunting them on opening day, and then how they transition throughout the year.
No, that's a good topic. You know, we often refer to huns and quail as covey birds.
Yep.
And in reality, all of these gallinaceous birds to some degree have the same winter survival strategy. And that is group up and stay together and eat together and evade predators together. Mm-hmm. It's just that quail do it for earlier in the season. And so, you know, when we go out on opening day, a lot of these birds are born in, you know, May, June, July, a lot of these chicks were.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we go out on opening day, these birds have far more confidence in their ability to hide than they have confidence in their ability to fly. And so their response to pressure September 1st is, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to duck my head and I'm going to hope that this thing moves past me.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows a dog to get relatively close, and that allows you to get really close. And their absolute last thought is, okay, well, he's coming. I've got to fly. When you get to today is October 20th. When you get to October 20th, mm-hmm. there's far more confidence in their ability to fly.
Yes.
As we've seen. And when they take wing, they might fly 10 miles. They're far more confident flyers than pheasants are. Now, a lot of slow twitch fibers in their wings, they can cover a whole lot of ground, and they're used to it. Mm-hmm. Food sources are pretty disparate and far apart. So when we get to this part of the season, as we saw yesterday, 31 birds in one group, that's a lot of eyes to try and evade, particularly if they're in thin cover, mm-hmm. which is why they like thin cover as well. Yep. So getting close to them is difficult right now. Temperatures are still making things a little bit difficult on the horses and the dogs, but I also like hunting them in the wintertime, and I think having a horse at that time of the year is beneficial also, because as we saw with the sharp-tailed grouse while we were out in what we call the leech pasture, we saw 15, 18 birds all mm-hmm. in the same place. That was probably all the birds in a 3,000-acre region.
You think so?
I honestly think
15
so.
15 birds and 3,000 acres?
Well, in that entire pasture, I think that was the majority of the birds in that particular area. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just can't sustain a whole lot of birds out there. And so I think part of it is you're not running into six or seven birds here and there. I mean, they're all in the same place. You know, so you just got to really cover mm-hmm. a lot of ground to find those birds.
Doesn't it just chap you, though, when they get up too far away and you're like, that's it for this whole pass here?
Well, I'm still shooting. I'm still shooting.
But I mean, there was some that got up, you know, 200 yards or 300 yards ahead of us, and you're thinking, damn it. That's it. That's all the birds here. But in my mind, these prairie birds get there quick, because there's always that last one that stays after the big covey flies away. But we've not been really seeing that this time. Unfortunately, we haven't been seeing that.
No, this time around, I think most of those birds got up in their groups and they've left together, mm-hmm. Which happens sometimes, but you're right. It is kind of fun to go in there and get some of those stragglers. You know, whenever we first started this, I read an article talking about late season hunting these birds. And if you're really wanting to get a big, mature male, like mountable type specimen, mm-hmm. hunting the outskirts of those large groups when they flush, that was actually something they advocated. Hmm. I've never experienced that, but, you know, it was something that someone said once. I think another thing about these birds is there's always something to learn about them. You know, as you've seen over the last few days, we've hunted a lot of different cover types,
yeah.
and the birds have been in a lot of different cover types. And particularly yesterday afternoon, as we're sitting there trying to figure out which direction ahead, it's kind of like, boy, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, we've covered everything, and there's been birds in all of it. Is it thin? Is it thick? Is it the top? Is it the bottom? Where do they want to be today? Mm-hmm. Which is really, I think, where the horses help us out.
The mileage.
Yeah.
Just the mileage. And I think... Yeah, elevation and being able to cover that much ground. You know, my dog, Daisy, she didn't hunt the first morning, but even putting her down at the second and third walk, she ran, I want to say, somewhere around like 42 or 44 miles. And we had, how many dogs have we had on this hunt? Nine?
Matt ran his two, you ran Daisy, yep. I ran mine. Grant ran three. So.
Yeah, we're missing one cowboy here. Grant had to go. He's not going to partake in our final hunt of this trip. He had to leave for work obligations. So, and I say Grant because he's part of your guys' cowboy team here. Who came up with the name Upland Cowboys?
Well, there was a young guy we met out in Wyoming that we hunted with a few times. Actually met him at a fly shop, and we kind of exchanged some fly fishing for some hunting.
Yeah.
And we were all wearing cowboy hats, and he started calling us the Upland Cowboys. Now,
stuck.
I wear a cowboy hat. I ride horses. I don't really claim to be a cowboy.
Yeah.
Just as a disclaimer there, but it stuck, and that's what we. I don't say I ever called myself that, but that's what people call us, so we go with it. And I guess it fits, you know, if you're going to be out there riding and on a horse mm-hmm. and wearing a cowboy hat and maybe that's as close as you get whenever it's upland hunting.
Yeah. Matt, you mentioned that that's not a true cowboy, right? What does it take to be a true cowboy in your opinion?
Well, so I'm a veterinarian just like Aaron is. Mm-hmm. And I specialize in feedlot medicine, which is the production phase in cattle right before they become, box beef essentially. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in my realm, the animals that I oversee are checked daily by men and women on horseback who do live a quote unquote cowboy lifestyle. They make mm-hmm. their living horseback.
On a horse.
And they know cattle, there's stockmanship involved. And those are cowboys. And I think to be a cowboy, you make your living on a horse. We just have fun on a horse. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very different situation. But as Aaron said, you know, Justin started calling us the Upland Cowboys, and that seemed to stick. And I guess it's there are worse monikers. I've been called worse. I've called Aaron worse this morning. But you know, I mean, it's just a fun way to kind of think of ourselves, I guess. And I don't take any offense to it, but you know, like you said, I mean, I wear spurs and I ride my horse and I shoot birds and
you fit. And also, and I will say that we made a mistake that we should never make, and a gate didn't get closed properly.
Good old open gate Grant.
Yes. Yep. And so a certain amount of cattle made it to the other side, and I think you can officially be a cowboy if you want to, because you brought them back in on horses. You guys did a heck of a job. I just sat there and watched and was kind of a little bit bummed that I wasn't out there on the horse bringing them back with you, because that's just something that I think a lot of kids dream about. A lot of people dream about being able to do that. And I think, you know, today I probably would want to do that on Fireball, but that first day, if I was running around out there, I don't know if I would have been as confident probably. Yeah. Because our first experience together didn't go wonderfully.
Should we talk about that?
We can talk about that. Yeah. So how not to get bucked off of a horse?
Well, and I don't want to misuse the term bucked.
True.
But
well, one of us didn't stay on. Both of us landed on the ground.
A person exited a horse, and it wasn't necessarily their choice to.
Yes.
So I guess by the Webster's Dictionary definition of bucked off a horse would probably apply.
Yeah.
But so in that situation, obviously, I can't tell you how many times I told you, well, we're not going to put you on a bronc. And I'll be damned, it looked like you were trying to train a colt that morning.
I know. But I don't think I made it 8 seconds, but it was close. It was very close.
We'll have to watch the playback on
Ben's
that.
Ben's over here, cameraman Ben, and he's Ben, how many seconds do you think I made it on that horse? Yeah. He's giving me 10 seconds.
Oh, man, I didn't hear the
whistle. He watched the footage back, and I made it about 10 seconds. So the television show is going to have some pretty entertaining moments. But, it kind of explain what happened there and why.
So the part of that you didn't see that morning. Whenever I caught her, mm-hmm. she was a little bit fresh. She had been ridden the previous weekend and did fine. And fresh meaning, you know, a horse that's kind of turned out the pasture sort of forgets their training and will try to reassert themselves whenever you bring them back up. And she wasn't that way. But I think what sort of set the ball rolling in a negative direction, we loaded Grant's horse in the front of my trailer in the morning, and I tried to load her next to Grant's horse. And she is a mare, and you know, mares are known for having some behavioral challenges. They're not necessarily problems. They're just other obstacles that geldings don't generally present. You know, she's hormonal. She's going to have some struggle. So we tried to put her on the trailer next to Grant.
There's a lot of things I could say about that comment.
But I'm going to choose not to.
As well.
I'm going to choose peace.
Yes.
So
Let's choose peace.
So we loaded her on the trailer next to Grant's horse, whom she did not appreciate. Mm-hmm. And so she reared back pretty hard to get away from him. I assume they were nipping and biting before that happened. She slipped out of her halter and hit her head pretty hard on the trailer exiting the trailer. And she had a little cut on her head. And so, you know, she got away. We wound up catching her back pretty easily, and she was okay. She just didn't want to stand next to him. We got him out, put her next to her buddy, who's my horse, Boone. And she seemed fine whenever I was saddling her up. She was a little bit nervous. And we probably should have rode her a little bit of the fresh off, but I thought she was in a good place. Her habit has always been on the ground. She may not have the best manners all the time. She was a retired barrel horse, but once you get on her back, everything is typically okay. And so we saddled her. Everything was all right. Once you got on her, she stood for a little bit, and then she got really antsy. She didn't like you personally. Mm-hmm. I don't want you to take that personally.
No offense taken.
But she personally did not like you. Mm-hmm. And so she decided she didn't want you on her anymore. And I think she chose peace. And instead of bucking, she decided she was going to lay down and play dead.
Yeah.
And so she did that. You exited I couldn't have asked you to do anything better. It was
Ben complimented textbook. Me a couple times afterwards. He says, "Hey, if you're gonna get thrown off a horse, you did it well. You did it well." And it was one of those things. I mean, it happened so quick.
Yeah.
And I felt terrible because this is your horse. I'm just coming down, and we're gonna go
think
ride.
Of how I felt, Travis.
But also they can sense. And I've ridden horses before, and I've hunted. You know, from horseback and. This is different. They were, I forget the kind of horses they were.
Tennessee Walkers.
Tennessee Walkers, just as calm and cool. But you kept texting me this whole week leading up to this. Hey, you know, make sure you got your cowboy boots. You want shoes that if you need to bail, you can bail quick. You don't want your grips, you know. And I was like, are you messing with me right now? Well, her nickname is what?
Well, her registered name on her paperwork is Fireball.
Yeah.
She's a little bit hot bred. But, you know, the thing I would tell you there, too, is a very cold-blooded Tennessee Walker probably wouldn't climb these hills quite as well as she did.
Yeah.
There's probably going to be a lot more quit in them. Mm-hmm. We asked a lot out of these horses. We always do. You know, it takes a level of athleticism. And that also comes with a level of let's say toxic behavior and but a level of spirit. She's spirited.
She got back up. I got back up and we did it again. We tried it again and it worked out.
And I got to say, Aaron and I have discussed this several times. I mean, watching you progress from that first moment of, I mean, you just jumped right back on her.
You have to get back on the saddle.
There wasn't a bit of fear in your eyes, man. And, I got to say, I was very proud. What'd you think of that?
Yeah, like I told you earlier, I would have had a hard time getting back on that horse.
Really?
You know, even me, like knowing horses, and I've been bucked off and climbed right back on. But if I wasn't a horse person and that had happened, I would have been like, guys, like we might have to find a different way of doing this because I'm not sure I would have had the courage to climb back on that when that was the first thing that happened to me.
Well,
and you know, you said it happened quickly. I was sitting there like, oh gosh, oh boy, what's happening? Like, what can I do to help? Nothing. Like, this has just got to play out. Like, can I say anything? Nope. You know, I was really impressed.
Well, I appreciate the compliments, guys, but I didn't think much. Maybe I should have thought more about it, I guess. I don't know. I think it was just a lot of buildup, a lot of the Fireball could probably tell that I was a little tense and maybe just, you know, thinking about it all week coming down, you know, and you're like, hell, you know, this terrain is tough and you got to be prepared to bail at any second. And I did last weekend. You said you had to, or somebody else jumped off and I'm like, dang. So I think it was just a lot of just that, buildup. And then horses are incredible creatures and they can sense that, can't they?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in time thinking about it, if I would have told you that, oh, it's going to be totally safe, everything's going to be fine, you got nothing to worry about, she's a deadhead. Honestly, I don't think the response would have been that way. I think she could really sense some anxiety in you that I personally placed inside of you. And I think her response to that anxiousness in you was to have a little bit of a freak out. And we saw whenever I would get on her, Aaron would get on her, she was totally fine. Horses are extremely perceptive. You know, they can sense those things just like a dog can. You know, we all know what our dogs do in the morning when you go to grab your shotgun. Mm-hmm. They know when it's hunting day. You know, they know when
you made a pretty interesting comment yesterday about it. You said it'd be kind of like grabbing another guy's dog and just taking it out hunting. It's just you need to be comfortable before.
Yeah, if you're gonna take your if you're gonna take your buddy's wife out to dinner, you know, it takes a little bit of respect. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. Those horses and those dogs, there's a lot of similarities there. And I always say, trust the dog. You know, whenever me and Matt hunt together, and we see a dog getting birdie, and like, oh, should we go over there? Yes, trust the dog.
Yep.
You know, the same thing goes with the horse. Trust the horse. You know, as we were pinning those cows, there was a pretty deep washout in front of me. We were going along at a pretty good speed. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can't do anything to help here. That horse, he sees it as well as I see it. He has to manage that. Mm-hmm. You know, and then another time as we were going along, there was a deep washout and his front feet dropped down in it and he kind of stumbled. At some point, you just have to trust that horse to do what's right for you, mm-hmm. you know. And if you don't know the horse, that's hard. But that's just kind of part of it. We trust the dogs to find the birds. We trust the horse to take care of us in some of those situations.
Speaking of the horses out there, how does that change the hunt for you? One, just what you're able to cover, but do you feel like the birds are a little bit more comfortable having horses because they're so used to cattle? I mean, this is cattle country.
That's a good point. And you know, I made this point yesterday as well, but and you'll see the same thing with deer. When you're horseback, you know, they don't really necessarily they have a lot of exposure to hoofed animals, and so the sound of hoof beats they're really comfortable with. Mm-hmm. I always make the joke from Jeremiah Johnson, you know, whenever he's walking behind his horse when he's hunting elk, and he says, elk don't know how many legs a horse has, you know. And it's like, well, prairie chickens don't know how many legs a horse has, and they don't know that there's someone sitting on top of them. Mm-hmm. You know, so I feel as though the actual hoof beats, and just like I said, deer hunting, you can get up pretty close to deer out here on horseback. We check these cows on horseback. We work them off of horseback. And so when we're hunting off of horseback, I think it just adds in another layer. I mean, the dogs are still on the ground and they're still, you know, predatory, and they're putting that pressure as well. But, you know, for me, hunting off a horse, it gives you the ability to overcome the obstacle of distance and overcome the exhaustion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we hunted like 9 or 10 miles this morning on horseback. And then this afternoon we went out and walked 4 or 5 more miles and we were fresh, you know, because we spent all morning on horseback, mm-hmm. you know. But I would tell anyone that a horse is not a cheat code. Yeah. It gives you a few more opportunities in mm-hmm. some ways, but it restricts a whole lot of other opportunities where, you know, a 4-strand barbed wire fence never stopped anybody until you get on a horse and you got to find a gate or you're not hunting on that side of the fence. Mm-hmm. And then obviously you run into other issues. You've got to keep a lot more animals healthy, you know, and you got to keep yourself healthy.
Right.
And so it's certainly not, it's not for everyone. And some days it's not the most effective way of hunting. If there's a lot of birds on the ground, you don't really need a horse. But if there's a whole lot of birds on the ground, you don't really need a dog either. It's like, it's just why we do the things that we do.
You do it because you love it.
Yes.
It's not because it's an efficient way to put meat on the table and very cost effective.
No, right? It's certainly not cost effective whatsoever.
What would, if you had to put you maybe don't want to do this, but try to put a price tag on poundage of prairie chicken, cost per pound.
Oh, are we talking dressed weight? Are we talking, weight, probably $10,000 a pound, yeah, probably between diesel, horse trailers, horses, dogs, dog food, guns, and equipment, probably yeah. $10,000 a pound.
So it's
premium stuff.
It's not necessarily, it's not a lucrative business.
No. No, not a lucrative business model whatsoever. And if I was forced to feed my family, I probably wouldn't feed them prairie chickens.
Prairie chicken is not.
And I love it. And, you know, Once again, I've talked about this at length. I mean, the most interesting thing about prairie chickens to me are the history of our interaction, European settlers with prairie chickens. And there have been times throughout history where they were a major food staple. And the heath hen on the East Coast, which was a close relative of the prairie chicken, what was it that we read? Sharecroppers, you know, back in the 1800s would write into their contracts that they didn't want to be fed heath hen more than three nights a week because they were so sick of it. And, you know, a lot of the folks you find out here that were homesteaders or Kincaiders came with the Kincaid Act. A lot of them now despise prairie chicken and refuse to eat it. And I honestly think it goes all the way back to their great-great-grandparents that were forced to eat it and probably said to themselves, one day I'm going to be able to feed my family beef
something else.
Or pork or something different, and I'm not going to have to feed them this. And so that's just come down through the ages where now, oh, no, you can't eat that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, but how many of those people do you actually think have tried it, you know? Or is it just been passed down and they don't even know what they're missing, right? Because prairie chicken's a very good meat. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had that discussion. You've said it before. A lot of people have said, oh, I'd rather eat sharp-tail than prairie chicken. And
I take it the other way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would take a prairie chicken over a sharp-tail every day.
And I've had people tell me that. And yeah, like Matt just said, the gizzard. Once we were out camping and we shot some prairie chickens and some sharp-tails that day, and we were frying stuff up and cut out the hearts and the gizzard. And I do not like gizzards, but a prairie chicken gizzard that day was one of the most delectable things I've ever had.
Could have been all the miles you put on. It tastes different afterwards.
You know, but it wasn't like a chicken gizzard. It was tender. It was almost like a little light meat. So I recommend that to anyone who goes and shoot one. Take the gizzards out and try it.
Right on. Well, I want to get into a little bit about hunting for the birds and giving some people some advice, but first I have a quick message from a couple of our sponsors.
Besides a bird dog, a shotgun, and a good pair of boots, the Onyx Hunt app is one of the most valuable hunting tools that I take into the field every single day. I've been talking about the Onyx Hunt app since we started producing this podcast, and that's simply because I use it on every hunt. Their app tells me everything that I need to know about the lands that I want to hunt and the lands that we can all legally hunt together. If you've used it yourself, then you know that the Onyx Hunt app shows your location on planet Earth and clearly lays out the land boundaries. It also tells you information about the type of property that you're on, like state land or the block management lands that we hunted last week in Montana. It's ideal for scouting before the hunt and during a hunt to help put together patterns. The app also has new features this year that show you the kind of crops that are in fields, which obviously is a big deal for us upland bird hunters. If you hunt grouse in the Northwoods, there's a timber cut layer to help you find ideal habitat. If you're planning to hunt North Dakota this year like me, then there's a very important layer that has just been added to the app. For the first time, landowners in North Dakota can post their property electronically. Onyx has you covered to make sure you don't cross the line on property that has been posted electronically. Onyx maps can be used in areas without cell coverage too. From the palm of your hand, Onyx maps always help you to know where you stand. For generations, bird hunters have hit the fields carrying some form of a vest or game pouch on their backs. Sometimes the vests rip, tear, and fall apart. Other times they're downright uncomfortable. That's why Chief Upland designed a vest that's durable, comfortable, and fits your needs. Their new Upland vest is fully customizable to fit the size and shape of all hunters. Plus, you can decide where you want to attach your shell pouches and accessories. Birds can be front-loaded into the game pouch and they fit nicely in the back without sagging. That's a big deal because the weight disbursement on your back and shoulders won't tire you out even with a full pouch of birds. The vest itself is extremely lightweight, weighing only 2.56 pounds. The material is built out of Cordura fabric, which is the same waterproof fabric used in tactical military gear. You can confidently hunt with a Chief Upland vest in some of the world's toughest environments. Order your Chief Upland vest now to make sure that you're ready for opening day. Push further and hunt longer with a game-changing vest from Chief Upland, built for your pursuit.
Hey, Upland hunters. If you're looking for a place to chase roosters this fall, you need to check out Huron, South Dakota. Here's why. The access to public hunting land is awesome. They have plenty of pet-friendly hotels for the hardest-working member of your hunting group. In addition, Huron is hosting a couple great events this hunting season, the first weekend of November.
the Ringneck Festival, a six-man competitive hunt which draws hunters from all over the country, and the Bird Dog Challenge. It's the opportunity you and your dog have been waiting for, complete with food, prizes, camaraderie, and so much more. The South Dakota pheasant season opens October 16th, so plan your hunting trip to Huron, South Dakota today. Check out the website and learn more at huronsd.com.
The wild is calling. Answer your thirst for adventure with Grain Belt Premium Beer. Bring the Grain Belt to the outdoors with their limited edition premium hunting season pack. It's available anywhere you can find premium 12-pack cans of Grain Belt.
All right, so we've been bucked off of a horse. I have been bucked off of a horse. We got back on. We've been out here for a couple days. We've seen a lot of birds. We've probably learned a lot. We found them in places we didn't expect to find them. This is a big open land. There's a lot of public land. There's also big, massive ranches. Matt, you live here and you work with a lot of these cattle ranchers. And you know, a single rancher may own 15,000 acres or 20,000 acres or lease it or whatever. But do you feel like, you know, we have deer season coming up, which I get, that's a big deal for everybody around the country when it comes to giving permission to bird hunters. But once hunting or deer season passes, do you feel like it's reasonable for an out-of-towner to knock on a rancher's door and ask permission to go hunt for prairie chicken? And what are the what's the likelihood that they would get permission?
Well, to be honest with you, and you've been exposed to this now, nobody here even mostly notices that they exist. Yeah. They kind of exist on the periphery of everyone's collective conscience out here. There are some folks that'll hunt around, but generally speaking, if you go up to someone and ask if you want to hunt prairie chickens, if they say no, yeah, it would be kind of unheard of, because they don't really have an impact on the landscape whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, obviously with deer, we've got some pronghorn antelope out here as well.
Yeah,
that people will sort of withhold rights to hunt them, and same thing with deer. We got some big mule deer. We've got, you know, the South Loop River runs right through here. We've got whitetail as well, but mostly in South Dakota, sort of this way, if you're not hunting pheasants or deer, nobody really cares. And so it's always worth thank God for OnX. You can look at ownership. You can see who owns what. I mean, I was on property that I've hunted for the past year, and I was still looking at OnX to make sure we were in the right areas and to see, you know, ownership to make sure we could cross this fence into that pasture and it was okay. But yeah, if you're shooting prairie dogs or prairie chickens, people seem to be pretty open to it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this big pasture land out here too, in the upper Midwest, or let's say Minnesota or Dakotas, a lot of times when you see a fence, that's marking the edge of the property. That's not always the case out here. That might just be separating a pasture where they're grazing cattle. So that's why, I mean, just having OnX makes such a big difference, because if you do talk to that landowner and he says, yeah, go ahead. And then he says, well, my land kind of runs, and you can show on the map, you can pull up that phone in your hand and say, well, it shows here, you know, is this accurate? Yep. Okay. I'll stay within the boundaries, you know, and head out and see what you can find out there. Interestingly, you know, there's a lot of pasture land out here, these rolling hills, beautiful, but there's also some crops mixed in. And that's where we've been finding a lot of these prairie chicken. In the mornings and evenings, they've been going to crops. And we joked yesterday that had we wanted to, when we saw the first bird sail over the top of one hill, we really could have stood on top of that hill and waited for more to come. And if we waited another 5 minutes, we would have had, I think Grant counted 28.
So yeah, 28 in that second group.
28 came over, and they would have been 15 feet above our heads.
Yeah.
Soaring right by, heading to the corn. So you could pass shoot them if you wanted to.
We were all thinking that. Nobody wanted to say it. Nobody wanted to teal hunt these things.
Yeah.
And I get it. We wanted a more upland experience, I suppose. But yeah, we certainly could have pass shot those things. Mm-hmm. You know, we're finally getting into the time of the year. I mean, the field they were flying into, they just picked that corn day before yesterday. You know, that's the reason we knew they were there.
And they finished it yesterday while we were there.
And they finished it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so, and they're going to be picking in other fields. You know, they're what I often say is this property, this area is so perfect for so many wildlife species because it is where the open prairie meets up with these riparian areas mm-hmm. and these sort of sediment basins where the South Loup River has deposited organic material for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. So we have really rich farm ground. We've also got semi-desolate sand hills, and we've got, you know, a fairly large river running through it. And so it's this feathering of all these habitats that creates almost this unheard of density of wildlife. And so, you know, prairie chickens, we kind of jokingly said as we were walking out in the pastures, and you know, you're looking at these rose hips like, oh, I bet they're eating these rose hips. And me and Grant looked at each other and said, no, I bet they're eating that corn. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they lived on these rose hips for a while, but once that corn comes down, mm-hmm. they're going to be in the corn, and yeah. they're going to be in the alfalfa, and they're going to be in the rye. You know, we've got small grain out there too. It's a buffet for them, and that's why, honestly, I think for prairie chickens, you'd be hard-pressed to find a higher density than what we have here, especially in the wintertime when you can really see them. I mean, it's nothing in the heart of wintertime to drive around and see 150 birds within 5 miles of my house. You know, I'll see 25 of them in my yard.
You mentioned something interesting a couple days ago about it's cooler weather, and you think a few more have moved in. Now, they're not a real migratory bird, but you believe there's something to kind of their seasonal movements.
Yes. And so generally speaking, gallinaceous birds are all non-migratory, mm-hmm. right?
There but is, like a sage grouse will travel, you know, a
couple hundred miles.
Exactly.
And there's a one of the subspecies of sharp-tailed grouse up in Canada is considered partially migratory. Mm-hmm. And so, as we said before, you know, these birds spend somewhere between 75 and 85% of their life within 4 miles of the lek site where their mother was bred, mm-hmm. essentially, right? But the other 15 to 20%, they might be 40 miles away from that site. And so, I mean, I think, you know, that partially the reason why a lot of these birds are hard to find in the wintertime is because they found the nearest crop. They're just structured to survive, right? Mm-hmm. That's their entire driving motivation. And if there's corn on the ground, they're probably going to be there, you know. And it seems as though prairie chickens have adapted to be a lot more tolerant of human behavior. And you'll read that both ways. You'll read sometimes sharp-tailed grouse are that way. There's one thing I found with these birds, spending time with them, doing my own research, chasing them, and admiring them, is there are no absolutes. And so, you know, I've read numerous times, these birds hate trees because it makes for a good perch for a hawk, which is their primary predator. We saw them fly out of and into trees.
Right, exactly.
I will commonly see them in trees in my own yard, you know, and you'll say, okay, well, prairie chickens will do that. Sharptail won't do that. Last year, I had 20 prairie chickens and like 3 sharptails in the same group. Mm-hmm. They're not supposed to do that either.
Right.
You know, there yep. are no absolutes. And I've got a feed yard north of here in Ainsworth that I've flushed sharptail out of the feed bunk while cattle were eating out of it. I'd say that's
they're survivors.
They're pretty open to whatever it takes.
And they'll also dance on the lek in October.
Yes.
That's something that I think most people would say, well, if you know anything about sharp tails or prairie chicken, even sage grouse, you know, just how important that lek is and the dancing grounds in the spring, that's a big deal. But we made it 300 yards from the horse trailer the first morning, and you're like, hey, you hear that? And I'm like, no, I'm deaf. And I said, what is
the exact conversation?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, what are you hearing? Because I think I hear them out in the field. And we moved on top of the hill and where we could see. And sure enough, there was, I don't know, a dozen birds, something probably, like that, yeah. out in the middle of a, I think it was actually an alfalfa field. And you said, that's actually a lek out there. And they were dancing. Yeah. They were booming, doing their thing out there. It was pretty cool to watch.
Yeah. So the interesting thing, so the daylight length right now is roughly the same as it is in, you know, April, May, whenever they get to their peak lekking behavior. And so in their minds, they're kind of doing this again. This is sort of a soft run right now. Now we're in our fall peak right now, and it'll kind of decrease down through the winter until they start getting their spring feathers on. But roughly 10 months out of the year, they're visiting that lek to some degree and exposing themselves the same way that they generally do. And there's a evolutionary reason behind that. If you think of prey chickens, like all of these gallinaceous birds, quail, pheasant, sage grouse are a little bit different, but like 60% of them die every year and get replaced by the next brood. Well, these lek sites have been there for hundreds, maybe thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years in the exact same spots. Mm-hmm. Well, with such a high turnover rate, how do they remain consistent in going to that same place? Well, they spend 10 months out of the year visiting that lek to some degree. They build the fidelity in the new, younger males in that area by kind of utilizing that space all year long. And so, yeah, we did see some mild lekking behavior. Obviously, females aren't visiting, but day length is the same. They're kind of doing a soft warm-up right now. And the hill right across the road from my house, we've got another prairie chicken lek up there. Pretty soon, we'll watch them dance in the
mornings. That's pretty cool.
Oh, and you can open the door and hear them. Mm-hmm. And it's such a wonderful place to live, Travis. I hope you can see a piece of why we're so in love with this place.
Well, I hope people enjoy it when we put this show together too, because as always, we try our best. I mean, these are wild birds. This is rugged landscape, but we try our best to show how real it is. And it's really an adventure. And I think any bird in the bag, Aaron, you mentioned this yesterday too, but just how special it is when you get one, when you're holding that bird in hand, everything that goes into it, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, so it's a lot of hard work getting to those birds, and when you get there, getting to complete the whole experience, and I've talked about it, you know, and you have a bad day of hunting, or it's not a bad day of hunting, you have a day where you aren't successful, and you tell yourself, oh, well, you know, everything else, you know, went really well, and I enjoyed it, and that's always true, but when you actually get to hold that bird and look at it, and, you know, all the things that we've just talked about as far as the horses, the dogs, that lekking behavior, all the things you've learned about that and habits. Mm-hmm. And then you actually get to see that bird. You know, we've talked a lot about prairie chickens and the bars on its chest.
Yep.
And that's something I really look for when those birds are in flight, especially where I'm at. Sometimes they're mixed in with pheasants and, you know, is it a hen pheasant or a prairie chicken? And sometimes the easiest way to tell that is when that bird goes up and he kind of flashes his chest at you, you see those bars.
That one that flushed right in front of me yesterday, it was 10, 15 yards maybe, and it got up facing me, and it was just perfect. I mean, I'll forever remember the bars you're talking about on the chest. I'm like, There you are. Because prior to that, I had flushed a hen pheasant and a rooster pheasant, you know, so the last two birds to explode under my feet, I knew for a fact were not the right species, but it just adds kind of to the cool factor out here. Like we talked about, you have a variety of different birds, but we specifically were hunting for prairie chicken, and then that bird got up. And when that bird went down, I thought for a second that I wasn't going to be the only one bucked off a horse because Matt hooted and hollered, and I thought that horse is going to throw you off too.
Well, my gelding's pretty acclimated to gunfire, and I think I told everyone, here are the rules. No loaded guns on a horse.
Yeah.
No shooting around someone still mounted on a horse. And I broke every rule then. And I was pretty confident I wasn't going to get thrown. But, you know, I kind of positioned myself horseback in a way that if that bird came up, I was hoping you wouldn't come my way.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think you'd have a shot if that bird went over the hill. And so, you know, we worked very, very, very hard. And I know you always say, well, I go on these trips, these guys want me to shoot a bird, but I just want someone to shoot a bird.
Yeah, it's not about me. It's an experience with all of you.
And in our collective minds, our thought process was, well, we want him to share every moment of what we enjoy out here. Mm-hmm. And by proxy, those that enjoy the TV show will share in that same experience. You know, I wanted you to capture that. I wanted you to feel that. I wanted you to hold your bird. And whenever it finally came together, you know, my dog Zeke kind of flushed a bird and pointed in a bird flush. The birds were really wild. Mm-hmm. These actually were in cover that sat. And so he held point. I got you off the horse through yelling and screaming and just a lot of emotional distress, I would say. I got you off the horse.
Come on. And by that point, I was a well-oiled machine. I was getting up and down.
Oh, yeah, you were. No, you were, yeah. You were flowing fine. But yeah. I was trying to convey the urgency in getting someone there with a gun.
Yep.
And you made it there. I released Zeke from a point, and you walked up on that bird, got up, took a shot, clipped it. Second shot just pummeled it.
Yeah.
And you know, in my mind, I don't know if we've shared this with the audience very much, but I've been manifesting you shooting a double on prairie chickens.
Everywhere we go, you're getting a double here. You're getting a double here. I'm like, you know what? You get a double.
I saw it in my head. I was going to create that into my reality. And after some time of thinking about it,
you know what though? I almost could have gotten a double because there was another bird there and it out of my pocket. And I always wear a hunting vest. I always wear a hunting vest. And I noticed you guys were not wearing a hunting vest. And it was so hot out here. I thought, well, we've got all these saddlebags. We want even weight on the horses going up the steep terrain. All right, I'll leave the vest back. So I got shells in my pocket. And I shoot that bird. And I go to reload my gun because right then another bird gets up. And I go to grab a shell out of my pocket. And what do I grab?
Chapstick.
My chapstick. So I did not get a shot.
Which neither loaded nor shot.
No, and I honestly don't know where that chapstick is now. I think it's on the side of that hill, and I'm a little sunburnt, and and it's okay. That bird got away because I did get that one.
But that was your double. But after some time and careful deliberation, I thought you took two shots, both of which hit a bird. In my mind,
they're tough
too.
They're not
sleep.
Like a grouse. That's one thing about prairie chicken that I've learned is, you know, like if you put a pellet, a BB in a grouse, rough grouse, sharp tail, it seems like, no, any grouse species, they're going down.
Yeah.
But a prairie chicken just, it doesn't, it, I mean, that you got to really put a good shot. It's like, not quite like a pheasant, but similar.
Well, and birds of the year are always, to me, a little bit easier to take down, so to speak. You know, if we're talking all juvenile birds, what you shot was an adult hen.
I only shoot the big ones.
Yeah, you only shoot adults. You know, you're the trophy hunter of all upland species. We know that for sure. But
appreciate
anytime
that.
You're chasing,
tell your friends.
My only two you've already met. Yeah. But no, I mean, anytime you're chasing adult birds, they are just more difficult. What I will say versus a pheasant. We got some dog farts going on underneath this table. It's stupid.
We talked about this earlier. When you have dogs, you always get to blame the dog. So it's a free for all. But yeah.
But anytime you're chasing adult birds, particularly these birds versus pheasants, if they hit the ground, you're going to be able to find them. They're not going to run very much, but they can still be pretty challenging to get down. I mean, they are built to withstand prairie falcons diving in and whacking them.
Yeah.
You know, and so they'll respond to BB sometimes the same way, shake it off and go die somewhere 3 miles away.
Mm-hmm. We'll wrap this up here quick because we're going to go hunting. Yep. But I do want to tell people, based on what we've experienced and what you've been seeing this season, how would you say the prairie chicken and sharp tail population is this season? There's still plenty of it left down here. We're not that far away from a lot of major cities. People can drive out and have plenty of opportunities to try to hunt these birds on their own. Do you think the numbers are stable, strong, down from the drought? Where are we at?
So I think, you know, based on what I've seen, the drought has had a pretty big impact on these birds. I still went out and shot my limit opening day. Mm. I knew exactly where to go. I didn't see a lot of birds. I feel as though this season, you can really sense that the drought's had an impact. We're still seeing some pretty decent recruitment in young birds. We're still seeing some decent bird numbers out there. If you know where to go, if you know how to hunt around water, find your water. Mm-hmm. But, you know, year to year, there's a general downward trend, you know, just like with all prairie species, just like with all of our upland birds, essentially. And so, you know, you really get a sense of that. But, it's based on weather. And this year we've had a rough weather year. So I by all means, I think people should still come, should still chase these birds, experience this. I certainly would not cancel my hunt based on anyone's forecast. Mm-hmm. But if I had to rank my my opinion of this season, optimistic versus pessimistic, I'd say I'm still pretty optimistic.
You're an optimistic guy. A lot of optimism all week. A lot of optimism, except for the text you kept sending me about that horse prior to getting here.
But looking back, I call that pragmatism.
You laid it out, man. You laid it out, and you were spot on. Fireball lived up to her reputation.
Fireball lived up to her reputation. Yep. And you surpassed your reputation.
I appreciate that. You earned your hat. Yeah, I love wearing the cowboy hat, and I felt like I fit in here for a little bit. I can say that I can say that I got thrown off a horse, and I got back on the horse. And I got to experience some incredible country out here. I would encourage anybody that has the opportunity to come down and hunt these kind of prairie birds to do it. Don't pass on the chance. And pheasant season opens up here in a few days, a couple weeks, and you can add pheasants if that's maybe it's a day where you a couple days of pheasant hunting, and then you say I'm gonna go drive up into the sand hills and give it a try, go for a walk. I think when you do that, you become a better hunter because you and your dog are going to be in places that you're not comfortable with or used to, and I wouldn't say comfortable, but you're going to be looking at the land differently, reading the topography, reading the habitat, and when you're successful, I think you'll be more successful the next time you go after the other birds too. That's what I tell people to experience that variety. So we're going to go hunt. Aaron, any final thoughts?
Oh, I just kind of talked about it last night at supper. You know, take that opportunity to go and do it.
Yeah.
You know, you hear people talk about all these different species that are out there. You know, take that opportunity to listen to these podcasts or watch that TV show. Take a few notes on it and just read about the bird and go and do it. It's always out there. It's always available, mm-hmm. You know, and you talking about pheasant season opening up, and at the risk of blowing up a spot, I will give a shout out to the Valentine Refuge. It's one of my favorite places.
Matt's cringing right now.
Yeah. If you want to go do a mixed bag hunt,
yeah,
there's a perfect opportunity to go walk around those sandhill lakes, mm-hmm. Shoot those pheasants out of those cattails, immediately walk into those hills and shoot sharptail or prairie chickens.
Yeah,
you know, if that's something you're looking to do, mm-hmm. There you go.
Yep.
So,
Matt, based on what you know about the state, the pheasant forecast, where would you send somebody that's interested in chasing pheasants?
No, that's a good point.
This is your chance to redirect them away from
up there. And I will say, I agree with Aaron. Yeah, there's some good mixed bag potential up there. There are certain areas of the state you can certainly find, you know, and now I'll push our Nebraska Upland Slam sponsored by Pheasants Forever.
Yeah.
You know, there's prizes available if you were able to harvest a bob white quail, pheasant, a sharptail, and a prairie chicken, all in the same season or all over the course of several seasons. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as far as where I live here, you know, we've discussed this some. I don't love pheasants. I really, really enjoy pheasant hunting. It's mm-hmm. like going to Astroworld. It's like a cheap thrill, right? You know, it's not something terribly memorable to me, but I certainly enjoy hunting pheasants, and I love all the conservation dollars that pheasants bring to our sports.
Yep.
And so I would never discredit a pheasant hunter. I love you guys. Keep doing what you do. I like the real native American birds, you know, mm-hmm. but despite that, you know, when you read through or you know, pheasant forecasts year to year, the Southwest region of the state is consistently the best region of the state, yeah. And no one goes there. And the Panhandle of the state, consistently one of our best regions. We've got corn there. We've got hills there. There are prairie chickens there as well. In the Panhandle, there's sharptail as well. A lot of guys go east. A lot of guys go to the Kansas border. And a lot of guys go to South Dakota. But the Southwest region of the state, I can't tell you enough. We've got Milo there, we've got corn there, we've got cattail.
It's the perfect mix.
I mean, it really is. You can go there and find a lot of birds.
And
you
gotta work for quail.
And I've done that, and
I would second exactly what you just said there.
Oh man, yeah, no, and definitely please go chase bobwhite quail. I mean, just I,
all right, I'll do it. Fine, I'll do it. But
you can't see it. I'm bending your arm pretty hard here.
I know. But first, we're going to get back after those prairie chickens. So we're going to cut it off here. We have a lot more we could share, and I want to probably have you guys on another podcast too, because a couple of veterinarians, a lot of knowledge there. We got a lot of dogs here. Everyone listening probably has their own dog, so I want to break down things you take into the field because I think that's an important topic. So. Would you do that? Come back another time?
We'd love to. And I just like this. We've had a great time with you.
I appreciate
that. You've worked your butt off. You've really earned our respect.
I would say actually shout out to Ben.
I got a shout out to Ben sitting over there. Yesterday afternoon, I could sense some exhaustion in him when he just wanted to fly that drone, and I don't blame him. But I mean, he's really stuck it out. He's put some hard miles in. And this has been such a great experience, and filming a TV show, I'd say it added in a few different challenges, but we didn't do anything differently than we normally would do on a hunt. I mean,
you normally miss that many times.
Oh no, more. Usually okay. I miss more than okay, that. Usually I'm not going to have a crowd of people watching me do it.
Right. No, nobody will see that. By the way, no, we won't put. I promise, we will not put that on.
Yeah. Well, at least we'll get to watch you bucked off a horse once, and then nearly bucked off a horse the second time.
But you can see the progress that I made there. I learned.
It's going to be a great episode. I can't wait to see it.
I'm excited.
But thanks a bunch for coming, Travis. We've had a blast.
Thanks for having us. I really appreciate you guys taking the time. And Grant, who couldn't be with us today, I'm sure he would have had plenty to say here as well. So appreciate you guys. This is a wonderful place, and I'm excited to share this adventure. We do have shows that are still airing right now on the Outdoor Channel. They'll be running through the end of December. We do have people asking us, when are they going to be available to stream? It's one of the most popular questions I get asked. They will be available the 1st of January to start streaming. We will let you know when that will happen, but you can watch them right now. Every week, a new episode on the Outdoor Channel, and we are going to leave now to go follow some bird dogs out in the field. I hope you do the same. Hunting season is here. It's a great time of the season. Hope you're enjoying it. The dogs are getting rowdy behind me, if you can hear that. So thank you again for joining us today. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Flush Podcast. I'm Travis Frank, reminding you to take the time to introduce someone new to the field.